Hello?
Hello?
Okay. Hey, it works.
What?
It works.
I can hardly hear you, though.
Well, that's because I was on speaker, but I'll...
You're much better now.
Okay. Okay.
Hello?
Hello?
All right. So I'm on... Who's on here? Jennifer, Ed.
Hi, Sarah.
Sarah.
Is it just us?
Thanks. Someone else?
It's Tina and Ken.
Tina and Ken.
Hi.
Hi,
Ed. Are you still in Seattle? Did you move there?
Yeah. We're still in Seattle in the same hotel.
Wait, are you still in the RSA hotel?
Same hotel, same awful city.
Wow.
Tell us how you really feel.
Oh, my God. We've eaten in every restaurant in Bellevue.
Did you go to the noodle place?
No, I didn't.
You should go there. It was really good. I would recommend it.
Hey, Ken, do you want to go to Siberia? You have to pay your own way.
There's a deal.
And you have to carry Ed's luggage.
That's right. How could you pass that up?
I think I'm going to bet on it, so they're looking for something else.
Oh, gosh.
That's a no, huh?
I think so, yeah.
Well,
this is a bit.
I would like to go if I could get if my way was being paid.
Well, they don't have.
Where in Siberia?
Irkutsk.
Where? By the biggest lake in the world, isn't it?
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. Baikal.
Baikal. Mm-hmm. Huh, that's cool.
Yeah.
But I have to be in Lithuania, and.
You thought you'd just dance over to Siberia, huh?
Go around the world was atrociously expensive. So.
Yeah, Pan M1 is no longer flying.
They don't do that, you know?
Right. Yep. I went to the Boeing Museum on last Saturday or Sunday. And they had all kinds of exhibits on Pan M1 and Pan M2 there.
Oh, they were the good old days.
They sure were.
Back when you didn't have to pay for your luggage and the stewardesses were cute.
Didn't have to pay to change. Ticket or any of that stuff.
Yeah. You had a comfortable seat.
I also went on the Concorde.
You did?
They have one of those there too. And that was really, it's really cramped.
Yeah, my
cousin. It's not a luxury liner at all.
Cousin used to fly that, and that's what he said. He said, you know, it's just great for the speed at which you get there, but other than that,
right,
it sucks. But
well, that used to be, what, 3 hours?
About 3 hours, New York to London.
That's amazing. Hmm. And how much money?
I don't know, but thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah, apparently entertainers very frequently the people that flew on that so that they could perform in London and in New York on the same night.
Oh, wow.
All right, let's see who's on here. Michael Charnas. Bill Barnett.
I'm here.
Carl.
Carl's here. Scott Parnell, Kathy won't make it again.
Right. Tatiana Farood.
You're breaking up, Ed.
Yeah.
All right, here. Johan.
Here.
Good, because you have the WebEx today. Tom and Kathy. Hannigan's here.
Here.
Dan Savage. Susan Tapert. Dale and Bill.
Yeah, we're here.
All right, anyone I didn't get? Michael. I got you, Elizabeth. Michael Charnas. Tatiana and Peter. Deepak. Tom and Kathy. Who just joined?
Tatiana.
Hey, Tatiana. Long time no see.
How are you?
I'm hanging in there. Dan Savage. All right. Well, let's see what we got here. It's too bad that Michael is not on. I just wanted to mention, for those of you who were not at the RSA or didn't stay until the end, on the last day of the meeting, Michael had a CFAS symposium, and it was extremely good, in my opinion. It was fairly well attended for being so late in the meeting, considering that the FASD study group met on Saturday, and a lot of people left. So he had a very good audience. And it was so good, in fact, that I think that I will propose that for the meeting in Vancouver next March as part of our half-day session, and include, in addition, if Scott and Kathy have their data on the genetic differences, to also include that.
I think it's a great idea.
Who just joined?
Hey, it's Tom at NoFAS.
Hey, Tom. So, I mean, it was, I thought, any other opinions on that for people who might have been there?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
I thought it was great.
So, Scott, do you think you'll have some additional data by March?
Next March, absolutely.
Okay, because you guys have some data on the genetic susceptibility, right?
Yes, we're collecting some more. So,
you know, I
we
think that
coordinate that. I mean, we could do additional analyses if there are additional genes we should be looking at.
Yeah,
and I think
you know, 20 minutes apiece, and that if there were five presentations, you know, that would fill up half of our morning session. And I think, I mean, I was very impressed with it, so I think it would be good. And Tatiana, the only thing you'll have to decide is if Leigh's going to do it again or you're going to do it.
Okay, yeah. So. We'll take care of that.
Hey, Ed, do you want brain in there?
If you have genetic differences. You know, now, we have a half day, so what I want to do is to put this in for the first part of that half-day session, then they'll take a break, and then to bring back some other CFAS investigators, which I've been trying to talk to Christina, who's the woman who handles it in Vancouver, but she's on vacation. So I haven't gotten any response to my emails for suggestions for the second part or for the entire half-day that we have. But I would imagine we will have some brain stuff there and hopefully some behavior. And,
okay. Just let us know, because either Christina, you've been...
Yeah, I talked with her at RSA about it, and she was very interested in going, so...
She's listening in, too, so she is very...
Yeah, so she did very well there, so...
Good.
That's what I was thinking, is that, you know, we'd put something together based on the theme around the genetic issue in the morning. And then they, in particular, were looking for kind of basic sciences. They felt that that was the weaker part of their meeting. So the people might want to consider going. It's the 6th International Conference on FASD. And this is the topic of this one is research results and relevance. integrating research policy and promising practices around the world. The conference dates are March 4th through 7th at the Westin Bayshore in Vancouver. And the meeting probably attracts about 1,500 people, and a lot of us have done presentations there, and I think we've all found it extremely interesting because it's researchers, practitioners, and families. So I've always felt that it's one of the better meetings that I get to go to. So if anyone, I mean, some people have already contacted me about their interest in doing it, and if you've already done that, fine. But if you haven't and you're interested, even if you're not part of the half-day CFAS symposium, they are still interested in putting you into a research session. So please consider that, all right? Someone else joined us?
It's Dan. Sorry, Ed, I was late. I had a dissertation defense.
All right.
And I'm here, Peter.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
So I hope you heard that spiel about trying to recreate the symposium at the meeting in Canada.
Yeah, I did.
Okay. Part of that symposium, well, I'll just go through some of my stuff here, and then we can turn it. We recently, most of us, a lot of us met while we were in Bellevue, and so I think everybody's aware of what's going on in CFAS. We are going, I need volunteers. We're going to try to update our publication policy and the data sharing policy, which are the two things that are kind of in limbo. We have statements about them, but neither one of them is rather complete. Bill Barnett has recently shared a potential a data sharing policy that we will need to go through and edit, modify, and then post and decide when phase one data would become available to interested scientists or the public. And that would not just be free access, but under control of the steering committee, which is all the PIs. So our publication policy, we have one. It needs to be refined and revised. I have asked for the publication policy of several NIAAA-sponsored consortium. Some of them are overkill for what we want. But I want to try to take the best parts of each of those publication policies and then put them into practice.
Are there particular issues you're trying to address?
No, it's that we need one of these, and I just want to try to forestall any problems in the future.
Okay.
Particularly as the data sharing comes out. And I think it would be in everyone's best interest to have something, you know, stated and down on paper that everybody can look at so that if they feel they should be included, that they are. And I think the big thing is, and maybe I'm thinking about this prematurely, but, you know, next year we'll have to write the renewal. And in talking to several people at the RSA meeting, it became very clear that in the fourth iteration of this, it's going to really be paramount to show the consortiumness of this and our collaborative and why they're getting more for their buck from a consortium than they are from a single R01 project or several R01 projects. And so I think if we have this publication policy, because I'm going to be trying to encourage more joint publications among the group and more translational work from the animal studies, publishing with the human studies. I think the genetics is a way to do that, and with Raj Miranda and Tatiana, So I just think it's important that we have it so we don't run into any problems. So what I need are volunteers who would be willing to sort through the publication policy and try to put one together, and also to take the and Bill Barnett is doing the data sharing policy, and he's in charge of that, and I don't know whether he has a committee helping him with that, or but we need people to also look at that. So I need volunteers.
We do have a committee, Ed.
Yep. Okay, so you're set on that.
Yep. And I'm glad to help with publications if you'd like me to. I mean, so I've been trying to do a template for, you know, preparing how we put in proposals and all that, so I'm glad to help with that.
And I'm happy to work with Tatiana on that.
Okay, and Tatiana, do you have access to the COGA one?
Yeah, I do, and that's partly why I'm offering right up front to do this and be part of it. I absolutely am doing it for that reason. Yeah.
All right, I talked to Antonio yesterday, and he said it's fine, that he would send it to us if we needed it, but if you have it,
we're good to go.
Hey, and Ed, this is Dale. I'm happy to join Sarah and Tatiana. And
all right, so that how about I make Tatiana chair? All right.
I am always happy to serve when Tatiana is chair.
All right. And then it's Sarah, Dale. Anyone else?
If you need more, I'm happy to help with that.
You English people probably have too many rules and regulations. So, and we have one. So it's Tatiana, Sarah, and Dale. Are now our publication committee. And if we could get that done somewhere by the 1st of September, that would be great. And Bill, on the next conference call, let's have a discussion on the data sharing policy. So if you could refine that, send it out to everybody for written comments, modify it, and then bring it up, and we can discuss that on our next conference call.
I actually saw it on the agenda for today's call, so.
Well, I think we're going to have a short discussion of it. Yeah, Jill put it on, and then Jill left on vacation, leaving me with a lot of questions. But it's on there, and so we can come back to that. What I want to do first is to give Johan a chance to do his thing. He did a really nice job out in, at RSA and had some interesting data.
The WebEx link is dated last month, at least in the one that Jill sent. Has anyone got on WebEx?
I'm on.
I'm on.
So I don't know what the months, I don't know where you're seeing that. If everyone's on, they should be able to see what's on.
Are you sure you had Jill's right email?
All I'm seeing is thanks for using WebEx.
Is Johan's slide supposed to be visible yet?
Well, Johan, are you ready? I can turn it over to you.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Turn it over to Johan, and let's see who can see what. And I'll pull up Jill's email. And yeah, I got it here. Yep.
I got it.
Anything?
I got it.
Elizabeth, can you get it?
No, just send it to me, because the only link I have says June 4th.
Oh, I'm connecting right now.
Oh, all right. Hold on. Here it comes, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
You got it?
Yeah.
So do people see my PowerPoint or my email?
Your PowerPoint.
PowerPoint.
Okay.
Yeah, PowerPoint.
Yeah.
The university is looking at your email. We don't really care about
it. Yeah, the NSA, probably.
All right. So is anyone not have the WebEx up?
Yep, I see it.
Good here.
Elizabeth?
Yeah, we're getting there.
Oh, all right, give Elizabeth 2 minutes and then, or a minute, and then we'll.
We found the right link.
Tell a joke.
Tell a joke.
That was for Johan.
Oh, Johan, tell a joke. You must have some zebrafish joke.
Oh, wow.
Why did the zebrafish cross the tank?
I don't think there are any zebrafish jokes, actually.
Oh, that's not possible.
And you need to change
that's
that.
Really sort of sad.
A void to be filled.
There's a whole genre right there of jokes.
Uh-huh. I can see my career as a stand-up comic now.
A zebrafish swims into a bar.
All right, we're done. I got one here. How many zebrafish does it take to change a light bulb? None. Zebrafish don't use them. It's a bad idea to mix electricity and water.
Bada-boom.
What is the favorite item of underwear for French fish? Zebra.
Oh,
God. What's a zebrafish favorite TV?
Okay, you should stop now, Ed.
Did you find a website?
Johan, please, start your presentation.
I did. There's a website with zebrafish jokes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Why are zebrafish so clever? Because they hang out in schools. What's black and white and red all over?
Zebrafish falling down the stairs.
What do you call?
Over to Johan.
Johan, please.
All right. So everyone sees the presentation.
Yeah.
So I thought that what I would use this time for was getting some feedback on this grant. So in our last meeting, it had just been reviewed, and so it wasn't a fundable score, but we got some comments back. And so I just thought this would be a good time when I have you all captive to solicit some critical feedback on what I'm thinking of, and I do actually have this in a fairly polished draft, too, so that I can send out to people if this goes well. So this is the set of aims from the original submission. Basically, it was three aims of genetic screens. So kind of a continuation of what I've been doing on the development grant. And this is my synopsis of the critiques that we got. So the ones that are underlined, I thought were the most substantial, and the ones that were not underlined were very easy to deal with, just writing issues. So that I've been trying to address all of these, and really these underlined ones, then I really kind of changed what the grant was kind of the focus of it. And so the biggest one, and this was in the summary, was that they weren't convinced that a screen based on craniofacial phenotypes was going to be highly relevant to human FASD. So, and then the next point that a couple reviewers questioned individual aspects of the genetic screen. And then related, I guess, to the first one was the first point is that a project elucidating mechanisms and potential rescue would be more impactful. And so that made me think about how to reorganize these into now a set of three new aims. And I'd have to say that one of the aspects, one reviewer actually mentioned that a behavioral aspect might be very nice. So this RSA meeting was phenomenal for me because I got to meet a grad student who's finishing up in the Gurley lab doing zebrafish behavior. He's interested in FASD genetics, so it seems like a perfect mix if I can get the money and get him convinced to come to my lab. And so that will be incorporated into this new set of aims. So basically, and please, anytime, give me any feedback you have. The idea is to, in the first aim, really do what we do well in zebrafish to track these cell behaviors. That's part of a cellular mechanism to the defect that I'll show you here in just a little bit with the WNT PCP pathway. So we can critically follow these cell behaviors very easily, give us some insight into that mechanism. And then the second specific aim is really then a way to to rescue these phenotypes? How can we decrease the teratogenicity of ethanol? And again, I'll go through these in more detail. We have a couple ways we're thinking that we can address that. And then basically the entire screening aspect, aside from a tiny bit in AIM 1, has now been collapsed into a single AIM, AIM 3, that Ben will be focused entirely on a forward genetic screen that we have preliminary data from already, that would then look both at craniofacial and neural defects and then apply that apply those mutants to behavioral tasks as well. So for AIM 1, just a little bit of background that will help inform the different points. So we found a genetic interaction between a member of the WNT-PCP signaling pathway. And so this is a pathway that's very important in early embryogenesis and neural development. And so it's crucially important in regulating cell behaviors and very specific cell behaviors that I'll show you in a little bit. And the other thing is that there's a transgenic zebrafish line that will enable us to label a population of cells that are disrupted in this interaction that I'll show you in a second, actually right now. So this is from our published screen where we took a look at zebrafish mutants and saw if there were any genetic interactions. And so our strongest genetic interaction was with this gene VANGL2. It's a member of this PCP pathway. And so in here, VANGL2 mutants, and if you add ethanol to a wild type fish, these things, I don't have an image of just wild type, but these all look fairly normal. We don't see any gross defects in either these cranial nerves, which is what you're looking up in the top panels, or this bit of the craniofacial skeleton. This is the midfacial skeleton, the palatal skeleton. But now when these embryos are treated with ethanol, so all of the mutants look like this, and my graduate student has been following up on this, and two-thirds of the heterozygotes now have very similar phenotypes with a similar ethanol treatment. So all these cranial nerves are extraordinarily hypoplastic. It looks like there might be misprojections here as well. This phenotype is of interest to us because Bill Dunty, when he was in Kathy's lab, also characterized that the cranial nerves were susceptible to ethanol teratogenesis. So now this is kind of a genetic way to approach that problem that was already characterized. And then down here in the craniofacial skeleton, you can see that this little midline bit is reduced to a nub, and the palatal skeleton falls off the more posterior portion of the skeleton.
Can you use your cursor, your pointer?
Yeah, we're not seeing the pointer.
Yep. You're not seeing it? Do you see it now?
Yeah,
I do.
Yep. Oh, okay, sorry, I was on the wrong screen. Yeah, so this little bit right here is reduced to a complete nub, and then this doesn't attach here posteriorly. And so these are all neural crest-derived structures. And so we can follow those in some transgenics that we're going to propose. So this pathway, the WNT-PCP pathway, is a really large pathway, and its function requires the protein complexes of the various members to be appropriately organized in actually very precise portions of the cell. And so we ran that pathway through the human data set with Leah and Tatiana, just looking to see if there were any interactions. And this is actually, we got significant interactions with about half of the pathway, actually. And so that's all the gene members are listed here. And so there seems to be strong evidence that this is conserved in humans, which I think motivates sort of a mechanistic analysis in zebrafish. So we want to then understand what causes these cellular defects. And so I already mentioned that there's a transgenic that labels those cranial nerves quite well, and that's very well characterized. People have used that to track axon guidance, and so we can propose readily to do that. The analysis of these neural crest cells and their behaviors is a little more complicated because they're deep in the embryo, and so this is our preliminary data really showing that we can track cell behaviors that are relevant to the Wnt planar cell polarity pathway in the developing phase. And so these are all really high magnification views of what's going to be the upper jaw and the palatal skeleton up here and the lower jaw down here. So the eye is this little black space, and the oral ectoderm, the future mouth, is right here. And so this is just an enhancer for a gene called GATA3. That's not what's so important, but what is important is that it drives expression in those cells that are going to generate the palatal skeleton. And so these are snapshots taken from a movie where we followed these two cells here and their behavior in a sea of neural crest. And so all the neural crests are labeled, are surrounded by red. So this is a membrane-bound MCHERRY. And then we're following the GFP. So cell behaviors that Wnt PCP mediates are cell intercalation. So that cell right there is doing that. So it's pushing its way in between these two adjacent cells that were neighbors at this time point. So we get an intercalation. And then in this next set, you see that this one cell rounds up and it undergoes a division. And then the adjacent cell undergoes a division in the same apparent orientation. So cell intercalations and oriented cell divisions, these are classic cell behaviors that the Wnt PCP pathway regulates. And so we're seeing them in the cells that are disrupted in this ethanol interaction.
So Johan,
yes.
When the reviewers were talking about adding behavior, it was the behavior of the cells and not the behavior of the fish. Is that right?
No, they wanted some fish behavior as well. And so that's not in this AIM, but so that's going to come up in AIM 3.
Okay.
Yeah. But how this relates to the reviewer's concern was, and I think the wording was something to the extent that the focus was purely genetic in the original grant, and so now this is getting more at a mechanism. So then what we're proposing to do now is to take a look at these Wnt-PC pathway members that are implicated in human and see if there are interactions with ethanol in zebrafish, and we can, like we did in Neil's paper, we can quantify that very nicely and see how strong these interactions are. And then the second two are basically tracking those cell behaviors to understand what's happening at the level of the cell. So what's happening to neural crest cell behaviors and cranial nerves. And then this is sort of the bottom line of what this AIM is going to give us, understanding the genetic and cellular characterization interaction.
Johan, I'm wondering, like John, if there's another word to use besides behavior to describe what's going on here. Is it like migration or some other kind of phenomena that would, you know, would minimize confusion with thinking about, you know, behaviors, normally think about these things, just to, because I was confused also, and
okay.
I just wonder if there's, another descriptor to help make that distinction.
Okay, no, yeah, I can readily do that. It's kind of funny. This is why it's good that I'm pitching it to you, because when I say behavior, I think of what a cell is doing. so it's good to hear that other people think of this differently. So, yeah, I can definitely choose some better wording for that. Okay, and so that was basically the pitch for the first AIM. Now the second AIM is really a way to improve what's happening. Background on this one that you need to know, it turns out that if you just take a look at the ethanol-sensitive genes that we've identified, many of these are clients for this protein here, heat-shock protein 90. Heat-shock protein 90 does a very important job. It's a protein chaperone that aids in folding proteins, and it's known to buffer against environmental insults. The other thing that's important for this screen is that there are a number of papers out there now that are using zebrafish for large chemical screens. So now once we understand that a particular gene interacts with ethanol, we can actually see, are there any chemicals out there that would ameliorate those defects? And as I'm going to propose, actually, we can screen plant phytochemicals as a promising source for these compounds. So this is just evidence that my group can rescue phenotypes, and so this, I think you're all familiar with this. We can take this interaction that we saw with PDGFRA when immunes and ethanol look like this, and you can activate this particular pathway, PI3K, with either this genetic modulation or with L-leucine and improve the embryos. This is actually, we're redoing this data right now, so this won't be the way this looks in the grant right now. But this is an experiment that I did years and years ago and forgot about until recently when I started thinking about HSP90 again. These are the numbers of embryos from a clutch that give the sorts of phenotypes that you see above here. And this chemical here inhibits HSP90, and it gives a very similar effect to what you see with ethanol. And actually, if you combine those two together, then you get something that we never see in either treatment alone. So it looks like this HSP90 pathway not only interacts with PDGFRA, but also ethanol. And so right now what we're doing is testing this in BANGL2 and quantifying this a little better than I did in my original analyses. But so the idea now in this aim is to see how this pathway responds to ethanol in vivo. Do we actually see an increase in HSP90 levels, which is what we would predict from other models? And then we can both activate and inhibit the HSP90 pathway, not only in those BANGL2 mutants, but do this more broadly, because our notion would be then that HSP90 is buffering perhaps a lot of these mutants against ethanol teratogenicity, and so we should be able to manipulate that there. And then the end of this is now an unbiased approach just to look for other suppressors of ethanol teratogenicity. So you can actually buy a chemical library of, I think it's like 324 phytochemicals arrayed in 96 well plates that then we can apply to our zebrafish mutants to find any that will suppress teratogenicity. And so then the third aims now, this is where the actual behavior will come in. So the background for this is that there is now nicely published characterization from this guy, Johan, in the Gerlai lab, showing that ethanol-exposed zebrafish have learning and social defects. And so that this now zebrafish is a good model for this. And so then what we want to do is, we can identify lots of novel, interesting ethanol-sensitive mutants in a forward genetic screen. And so this is something that's ongoing in the lab, and we've got, so these are different mutants that we've identified. You'll see that only two of them have something that doesn't start with an AU. So AU number, that's just an allele number. That means that we don't actually know what the gene is yet, but it's a mutant that we've isolated. And so we've identified the mutation in two of these. This is DUSP1. If you heard Ben's talk, this is the one that he talked about. It regulates MAPK signaling. And then this one's actually a novel gene, but it looks a lot like the low-density lipoprotein receptor. And we have two more of these that we're sequencing right now, so we should know their identity here pretty soon. But the key is that neither of these genes have shown up in any forward genetic screen before, and so these are novel. We're identifying new stuff. It's also very interesting to us that most of these mutants don't have any phenotypes that we observe if they haven't been exposed to ethanol, but now when they do have an ethanol exposure, we have oftentimes extremely profound defects in these mutants. And so we can get lots of mutants from the forward genetic screen. Our whole genome approach speeds up identifying what these are. And then the other bit of preliminary data, again, comes from our screen with Sangle 2, where all the mutants that we found that gave neural defects also had an associated facial phenotype. And that's important for us because it's extremely easy for us to screen for facial phenotypes. We can do this in a fairly high throughput fashion. But now, if you want to examine neural defects or behavioral defects, that then becomes a very complicated screen. And so what we're proposing to do then is to take a look first to ramp up the forward genetic screen, look for facial phenotypes, and then look at these neural defects that would be associated with it in the transgenic backgrounds that I talked about, and then quantify the behavioral deficits using these assays that the Gerlei lab has developed. And again, hopefully if we can get his student in our lab, then we can say that he can do those. And so then the bottom line is that this will, you know, really elucidate the broad causes of FASD, numerous defects, both the facial, neural, and behavioral deficits. So that's what I had. I appreciate if any comments, more comments that you have, if you think it sounds
good. Could you put up the critique slide again? I think it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Johan, it's Scott. Are you going to do the behavioral test with the combination of your knockouts and the ethanol exposure?
Yeah.
Or you can do it with just ethanol?
No, it would be the combination of the genetics would be what we would be doing. Yeah. And so then can we see interactions, you know, between genotype across exposure and non-exposure?
So you get a spectrum, right? With mm-hmm. any given a knockout, do you expect to have neurobehavioral deficits in zebrafish that don't have craniofacial deficits? And could you even test the zebrafish that have craniofacial deficits?
Right. Yeah. So I think that So I guess one thing that I didn't bring up would be that the ethanol treatment would be slightly different when we went to the behavioral assay.
Okay.
So we do a longer screen to get our craniofacial because obviously the ones with severe craniofacial defects will die and we can't test them.
Okay.
Behavior. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Was that your concern? Because
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
That you would get a bunch of zebrafish that. Unless you also got neurobehavioral deficits in the ones that didn't show craniofacial deficits, which is possible. Maybe.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so I was looking at Johan's data with him, and it was really nice. He actually gets sensitization with a fairly low dose of ethanol, lower than what we see that we get craniofacial defects, and with a very short pulse, so 2 hours. So the idea then we could identify genes that are developmentally important through the craniofacial screen and with their interaction with ethanol. But then presumably the behavioral screen is not going to be as severe of an insult to the embryo.
Okay.
So does the they were sort of skeptical of the value of the craniofacial analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Was that because of the doses? And is the issue really boiled down to a dose response curve? Is that you're at one end showing craniofacial effects, and you still see behavioral effects at a much lower level?
Yeah, that's what I think we will see. So the original critique about the significance of the craniofacial phenotype, though, was worded different in that the most profound defects are the neural and behavioral, and so they were not compelled that craniofacial would tell us much about that. And so I guess the one thing that I didn't say, so I've hit that more directly, you know, with data that, you know, from Mike Sudi's paper showing correlations of face to learning, and say that, you know, actually we think the face does provide some insight. But I also felt that we should maybe try to directly test that too, if these genes are altering behavior in any way.
And it's still the genetic interaction though is necessary. So at lower doses, is alcohol interacting with these mutants at ways that increase the likelihood of neurobehavioral effects, independent of whether or not they're independent, I suppose, but it's still going to be a lower dose of the craniofacial effects.
Right.
That you would see, you could see behavioral effects in your social learning or your learning, maybe either at lower doses or maybe with some mutants that where you don't see the craniofacial defects. I guess that was the question, and I think the idea maybe is that at lower doses you may see the behavioral effects even without the craniofacial. So, and then how would the mutants, you know, how would they shift those sensitivities? I'm trying to understand what it was the reviewers might have been looking for in here. So the other thing I would say, Johan, is in AIM-3, you've got a number of things going on in there. It almost seems like the behavioral assessments of genetic susceptibilities should stand on its own. The way AIM-3 is currently worded, I don't think it really describes what the various things that are going on in there, and I think there's a, you know, there's multiple, you know, kinds of experiments you're doing. So,
This is Christina Euben with Elizabeth Saul. I had a broader comment, I guess. One thing that I really like about this proposal, and I really enjoyed the talk at RSA, was one thing that I think the zebrafish is such a great model for is that it's very complex model, but it's not as complex as rodents. And it's kind of, to me, seems like a bridge between even more simplistic organisms like the C. elegans. And Kathy Rankin's done a lot of genetics and dosing, prenatal alcohol exposure, dosing effects with the C. elegans, that maybe when you're talking about behaviors, you already have the more complex behaviors with social interactions for the zebrafish, which is a great bridge to the rodent models. But what about even just simple things like activity, and you can relate it down to simple organisms, kind of like a bridge?
Okay. Yeah, so there are transgenics that would be useful for looking at activity.
I think a lot of the same programs that you use just to look at activity even in rodents, I know Kathy Rankin's used some of them to look at C. elegans where you just kind of have a video of it and it quantifies locomotion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she finds a lot of dose effects, and the dosing effects, of course, depend on what genetic variant she's looking at and whatnot. So, I don't know. It just seems like a really good opportunity to kind of highlight.
I'm going to try to move this along here. But, Tatiana, do you think it'd be useful if you read the introduction and the innovative part of this grant?
Absolutely. So I had read the critiques, and we'd actually had an email exchange about this as well, but I'd be glad to. I mean, I'm glad to read the whole grant, honestly.
Yeah, I think because given, you know, Peter's and your data on the face and subsequent behavior, you might be able to add a little richness in there to give the reviewers and get them over the hump of the significance.
I'd be glad to. And I think, you know, Peter, and I don't want to speak for you, Peter, but I'm sure, you know, we'd be glad to help.
I think the hook might be, I don't want to belabor this, but I think, you know, the hook might be that what the human analyses are showing is that there are these more subtle craniofacial features.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that you have very large effects, Johanna. Maybe you're going to be seeing subtler effects at lower doses that at the same time you're seeing the behavioral effects.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole work that was shown with the filtrum will be a great example, you know, knocking out, complete loss of filtrum versus just some more subtle filtrum defects. I think it would be a great example of that.
All right. I appreciate that. I wanted to give Bill a chance to discuss. Does everyone have the copy of the publication policy that Bill sent out this morning?
Yes.
It's publication policy? You mean
the data sharing?
The data sharing policy.
Yeah. So, thank you, Ed. So what I did was I sent this around and got comments back from Tatiana and from Bill Dunty. And I think their comments, I looked at these comments, they look very good. And I think that if anybody else in the steering committee wants to have more comments, I'm happy to incorporate them and then do a next clean version that incorporates all these comments. I'm happy with the comments, like I said, from Tatiana and Bill. I think they add to it a lot. There's a little bit of cleaning up between, you know, where the data use agreement gets put into the request process and maybe fleshing out a little bit about what exactly we want people to put in their proposals to get access to the data. But other than that, I think it's pretty good as an overall policy. But if anybody has questions, I'm happy to take those now. And I have ready to take notes on them, too, questions.
I guess, so let me ask you, so sorry, Bill, it is my mistake for not following up after it. So John Hannigan had sent a number of questions. And in this new version, I didn't see his questions stuck in there with it. And I guess some of those I think we do need to also discuss.
Okay. Oh, I see that. Right. Okay. That
was. Did I miss them in the new version that you sent? I didn't think they were in there.
No, I missed putting them in the new version. How's that?
Okay. And the reason I bring it up is because I wasn't sure if we were going to do a call, and I probably should have pushed the issue. So some of the questions John asked, I wasn't sure I completely knew where they were coming from, but I thought we might need a broader discussion about that. So it might be good if we just had a call of a subset of us from the committee and maybe went through that. So I think part of the question is, you know, what are we expecting? I mean, just some of his questions are really broad. John, you're on the phone, aren't you?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah. So I think some of the questions you asked are really broad, and so I didn't necessarily always know the answer to them. And so I think it's really important that your questions be in this aggregated document.
Frank, I don't remember what I had said. I'm trying to find that file now. But
I have it.
You want.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think we really need this before we go over the document. I don't want to delay you, Bill. I'm really sorry that I.
Oh no,
I have a question. This is Sarah. I'm on the committee, and I don't know if I've seen John Hannigan's comment.
Okay,
so
I can.
If you could send them more broadly,
I'll forward them back to all of you, and then also to you, Sarah. How about that?
That would be great. Thanks.
Okay.
So do you? All right, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Ed.
No, I was just wondering if you wanted to reconvene your committee after you all see John's comments and bring this up at the next call.
Sorry.
And perhaps addressing some of the issues that are also have been raised, I can see in the comment section here. You know,
all right.
Maybe just have this data sharing statement, but then maybe like an appendix with specifics about how long it would run and everything like that.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I think that's fine. I think that's fine. So I just wanted to make sure that if no other thing happened, at least that this was in front of the entire steering committee so that you guys had a sense of what we were up to and where we were going.
Worked for me.
Okay. All right.
Go ahead.
So I think that, the directions I have are to we're going to share John's comments around with the data access committee, and then we will reconvene and then come up with another draft to come back for the August meeting.
Sounds like, yeah.
Yeah, and if we need a quick call, we could do that too, Bill. I mean, I don't want to create a call, but I think it might be valuable. I don't know.
I think it will be, just to make sure the committee's on the same page.
Let me know if you need Carol to help set it up. She can help if you need her to.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
All right. While we were on the phone, I got an email from the Canadian folks about the thing, and they said it was the half day or first half of the day. They said looked fascinating, and thank you for having these people present. They do want to include some stuff on brain imaging in our session. And does anyone know who would be good, or maybe it would have to be split? They asked about brain imaging in animals and humans.
Kathy would have a brain.
Scott?
Yeah.
That'd be you guys.
We've done all the animal brain imaging.
Right.
During early gestation, anyway. That's all we've done.
So you kind of have to, they want both human and animal. So, you know,
in one talk?
Yeah. They're talking about...
Peter, is it brain work you've also done with Kathy, or is it face?
No, brain as well.
Yeah, I mean, that would be potentially one. I mean, he can certainly be part of that bridge, I would think.
Yeah.
All right, so do you think that that Scott and Elizabeth work together to come up with a joint type of plenary?
Yes.
Yeah, we could do that.
And Christina can work with us as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, both animal and human. Not animal imaging, but animal brain.
Yeah. All right, I'll get back to them about this. And does anyone know Jenny Rangmar?
No.
Not familiar.
Hmm.
Name sounds familiar. What's the context?
She's a
psychologist.
Sweden. She's a psychologist
in
Sweden. All right.
I don't think so.
All righty. They have some interesting data on long-term consequences in the adults. But I want to know if anyone's ever heard her talk or whatever. Seen anything else by her? All right.
How do you spell her name?
Rangmar.
Mar, okay.
And it's unpublished data, so you can't find it.
Okay.
Alrighty. Let's see. Did I cover everything on my agenda? Yep. We have 5 minutes left. If anyone would like to fill us in on some fantastic new things. Elizabeth, you know, you had, I asked Jeff about this at the RSA, but he really didn't, what's going on with the functional connectivity stuff? Because I see that you have two papers that you're working on.
Well, not with functional connectivity. We're looking at VTI and structural. So where we are with that is actually Jeff starting to put together some sort of analysis pipelines. You know, graph theory, functional connectivity with CFAS-3, and we'll bring in the multi-site data as soon as he's ready for it. Jeff's perspective is a little bit different than mine in that he feels strongly that the kinds of analyses he does, it doesn't make sense for him to run analyses before he's, you know, kind of got a more complete data set. So now that we've 200 of our proposed 240 time one scans, it's a good time for him to start working on it, which he is. And I think we need to talk with Sarah and Claire and all the, you know, all the people who collected the brain imaging data, how we want to start the first analyses. And in collaboration with Jeff, of course. He has all the data. Does that answer your question?
I guess.
Okay. Most, you know, everything that we're working on now, PropD has now a second paper that's in press, right, in a cerebral cortex. And that's with all three sites, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. But remember, that's from CFAS-2 data. So almost everything my people are doing right now is CFAS-2, and Jeff could absolutely have the data, but I don't know that he wants to work on the backlog. I think he wants to start working on, because, you know, before we didn't even do structural connectivity or functional connectivity in CFAS-2.
All right. Well, I will let you two work that out. The one last thing I should mention is Dale, Bill, and I were discussing, again, this long-term prospect of writing a renewal application and to kind of figure out where we were. And I know everyone's just finished their progress report for NIAAA, and we had it for Bill collected everything. You will be getting an email from me, though, where I'm interested in where we are in terms, where each investigator is in terms of each of the specific games, and if we could get a timeline for this. And, you know, part of the thing is we need to start to consider where CFAS is going to go in the next iteration of whether it some of the directions may change. You know, George Kube mentioned that he's very much interested in interventions, prevention, and whether we need to include some of that in the next iteration. And so if you get it, it's not like I'm trying to burden you down on with progress reports, but just so that we can start thinking about this, because, you know, it's unclear who may take charge of the next iteration of this if I really decide to move on to do something else. So you may be getting an email from me about that in the very near future, okay?
Okay.
And with that, it's our hour's up. Any other comments that people would like to make? Okie doke. Thank you very much. Anything from NIAAA?
Now, I was going to just mention to people that Dr. Kube gave an NIAAA update at RSA and rolled out, I think it's 9 different points of emphasis, and as Ed just said, 2 of them are FASD-related, preventing drinking, preventing FASD, and then interventions for affected children. So, you know, I think this group can address those things dense and can be thinking about, you know, future directions along those lines. I think they'll be well received here. And he also took the time to stop in at the FASD study group, so I think that sends a pretty strong message as well.
And he named Ken Warren the FASD czar. So.
Bill Dunphy is the FASD starlet.
But you know, I know it's a long time away to think about the renewal, but I think the sooner we get thinking about it, the better off we'll be in attracting potential new investigators to CFAS and deciding directions. And one of the issues is that treatment research is expensive for the most part, and, you know, we do have budget limitations, so it's, you know, a balancing act between what to include, what not to include, and how much money goes toward everything. So just trying to get an idea of where we are and where we could be going in the future. And so I don't want to burden you, but I'm trying to figure out my life as well. So, all right?
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks, everybody. Take care, everybody.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.